Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name's Linda Rose. I am an immigration lawyer. My law firm is Rose Immigration Law Firm, and it actually is located just across the street on the other side of West End in the Lowe's Vanderbilt Plaza Hotel. And I have my business cards down here, so please help yourself to my business card. I also am a faculty member here at Vanderbilt. I'm a faculty member at the law school where I teach immigration law every year. So Ms. Weiss called me about a week ago and said, we've got many foreign students who are up in arms over the H-1B crisis. And that is no surprise. So I'm going to talk to you today about H-1Bs. Some of what I may talk about might be a little basic for you. For others of you, it might be all brand new information. I don't know everybody's background and understanding, but I'm positive of one thing. I'm positive that you all have been on the internet reading different information about the H-1B crisis. And you hear different things. Some of it's correct and some of it's not. So I'm going to tell you what I know and what I know to be correct, and you can rely on that. Now, consider this, however, that this is not formal legal advice. If you would like to come and have a legal consultation with my office, I would invite you to do that. My normal consultation fee is $300. But we will do a consultation for an Owen graduate at a reduced rate of $200. I'll have you see one of the other lawyers, either me or one of the other lawyers in the office, but just identify yourself as an Owen graduate student, and we will automatically offer you that discount. Let me just quickly tell you a little bit about myself, a little bit about my law firm, and then we'll just get right into the H-1B stuff that I know you all want to know about. My law firm is Rose Immigration Law Firm. We practice exclusively immigration and nationality law. Most of what we do is called business immigration. So we work with students like yourselves. We work with corporations that are hiring foreign professionals. And we do the H-1B work, we do the permanent residence work. We also do other types of immigration. We do naturalization litigation when somebody has filed for citizenship and the government has delayed unreasonably. We litigate the U.S. government to get an adjudication on a naturalization case. We do family immigration cases, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that today as well. And we handle other general immigration matters. But primarily what we do is business immigration. So the types of questions that you have are right in line with what I do. And if you would like to go to my website and find out more about me, it is roseimmigration.com, So please take a look at the website, and I will be here for the next hour or so. I'm not sure how much time I was given. Does anyone know how long we're supposed to be here?
Classes start at 2,
so. Okay, well then we better start talking right away. So I'm here for the next 50 minutes. I'm going to run through some of my highlights for you, and then we will just answer your questions that I didn't cover. I did get a bunch of questions, but I only saw those about 15 minutes before I left, so I'm not positive that all of the answers to these questions that you all have emailed are in my presentation, but I know that some of them are. And those that aren't, you'll just raise your hand and pose the question. If I can answer it, I will. If I can't, I'll tell you. And if I can't, I'll try to find out the answer and send it back to you. Okay, instead of using a PowerPoint, let's just talk about what happens on after your graduation. I assume that most of you are getting ready to graduate from the Owen School of Management. Is that correct? Well, that deserves a congratulations. except where you're going to work now, right? Okay, most of you should have OPT. Is everyone familiar with OPT?
Yes.
Okay, you need to apply for your OPT status early on because it takes the government at least 90 days to issue the work authorization document. Are you aware of that and aware of what I mean by that? Since everyone's not shaking their heads yes, let me just quickly say that OPT is your optional practical training that you get after you earn your degree. And it's good for 1 year. It allows you to go into the open market to work in your field. You can't be a waiter at O'Charlie's. I'm sure with your graduate degrees, that's not what you want to do anyway, unless you're in hotel and restaurant management. But you can work in your field of business administration. Your OPT is, did it come over? Great. Your OPT is good for 1 year. Now, most of you will be on OPT. It'll start sometime in June. Is that a good estimate for some of you? Have you applied for your applied for the EAD? You can't start working until the employment authorization document comes in the mail. So that's good. You've got that. But I know that you know that your OPT is only going to take you through till June of next year. And really what you need to continue working is H-1B status. And is it correct that everyone here has had an employer petition for H-1B?
Yes. Most, not
most
all.
Most of you? Okay.
Some of them are first years.
Okay. So if you were expecting an H-1B, your attorney or your employer should have filed an H-1B petition on April 1st. And did that happen? Now we know that there are 65,000 H-1B visa numbers given out every fiscal year. Fiscal year begins on October 1, but the regulations allow employers to apply or file a petition 6 months ahead of time. And that's why everyone was applying on April 1st, because we knew that the numbers were going to run out early on. Last year they ran out over Memorial Day weekend, the end of May. The year before that they ran out in August. So each year the time period was getting shorter and shorter. My law firm, just like your employers, had cases ready to go in the mail on Friday before April 1st in anticipation of the H-1B crunch. I knew that there would be many, many more petitions than 65,000 filed on that day. The last report that I had, and you've probably been getting this from Karen, let's see, how do I smooth it ahead?
Click.
Yeah. Okay, let's just get up. I just want to get to where I am now.
Sure.
You can all drink champagne on your graduation day. Is that clear for you? Okay. All right, we're talking about, everyone knows what the OP, we're talking about the H-1B numerical. Okay, let's go to the next one. All right. Well, this is not the one that I, okay. Let's see where we were. Okay, on April, it was actually April 2nd and April 3rd, because the 1st fell on a Sunday, the government reported that it received 133 petitions. But actually, that wasn't 133 petitions, it was 133 pieces of mail. The boxes that I sent from my office, for example, contained 20 petitions each. So you can just imagine, and I'm just a small office. We have three lawyers and three paralegals and, you know, a few more staff. I've got about a staff of 10 in my office. So if we sent out some boxes of H-1B petitions with 20 petitions in each box, imagine what the big law firms did. So there were 133 pieces of mail, each containing many more petitions. So there were, you know, easily, I think the estimate now is about 180,000 petitions were received on April 2nd and April 3rd. So that comes out to be so you've all taken advanced statistics. So what chance does that give you if you're only 65,000? You know, 1 in 3, 1 in 4? You know, it's a pretty low chance of your petition being selected. What the government is going to do is they're going to run a lottery. They will select the petitions randomly for selection or for H-1B approval. And of course the problem is that some of you are going to run it. Those of you who get selected could run into the H-1B cap gap. Does everyone understand what that is? Okay. There's a definite no over there. H-1B cap gap. Let's say you're one of the lucky ones and your employer's petition is chosen for H-1B status. Your OPT begins on June 1. It'll go through till June 1, 2008. Luckily, you're going to get on to H-1B on October 1. And the reason you're giving up your OPT status to get onto H-1B is because if you waited until the following fiscal year, you would have a gap in your status. And the government considers that illegal status. And we don't want that to happen to you. So those of you who get selected for H-1B, you'll be safe. Those of you who don't, you're going to run into the H-1B cap gap. And if you aren't selected at all, you will have a period of no status. And this is a problem. And here's what I'm going to talk about today, is what we can do to secure your status if you are either going to be in the cap gap or if you're going to have no status whatsoever during the H-1B crisis. Now, I'm going to talk about all the different visa categories that are available. You can go back to your employers and tell them that there are other options. You'll see some of them will apply to you and some of them won't. The first thing is to consider is that there's a carve-out for Chileans and Singapore, so the 65,000 isn't even going to go as far as we think. There's a carve-out for Chileans and Singaporeans. Okay, here's the good news. Master's degree holders, there's a carve-out of 20,000, meaning that there are 20,000 H-1B petitions reserved for people with master's degrees, and that's most of you here. And the good news is that the master's degree, we have an initial count from the Immigration Service, and the master's degree carve-outs have not been used up. You said a number a little bit ago, I think it was around
12,900.
Yeah. So there's a healthy 7,000, 8,000 H-1Bs left for master's degree holders. So that's a possibility. Now, if you're not a master's degree holder, I know the other question going around is, what happens if you filed a petition for an H-1B under your using your undergraduate degree because you didn't yet have the master's degree, but now you do have a master's degree, or you will have a master's degree very soon. There are two ways to go about it. To me, the easiest, safest way is to, because we know that there are master's degrees petitions still available, would be file a brand new petition under the master's degree. That, I know, will work. Your employer can just reproduce the petition, redo the prevailing wage, etc., do a brand new petition with you having a master's degree. That way you will get into the carve-out. Another option, let me just say my option and then I'll find out if that's your question. Another option would be to try and convert the existing petition to a master's degree carve-out petition. I don't know if that works or not. There has been no formal announcement by the Immigration Service as to whether or not they will accept that. So my thought is, why not try? So I would definitely do that as well. So I would, and that, again, that's a job for the employer or the employer's lawyer to go ahead and attempt to upgrade. And I believe that this issue will be addressed by the Immigration Service very shortly. I happen to be on the national committee that liaises with the USCIS headquarters. And this is probably one of the immediate issues that we will bring to USCIS headquarters within the next few weeks as to whether or not they will permit H-1B petitions filed under a bachelor's degree to be converted and upgraded to a master's degree. On the one hand, the law is this. The law is that the person has to qualify at the time of filing. And so the government is generally going to look at what did the person have at the time of filing. However, given the apparent crisis that we are facing right now with the H-1B situation, I am hopeful that USCIS will issue a policy, not a regulation, because if they issue a regulation, that takes months and months to get approved. But they may be able to issue a policy that will not be in violation of the regulations, permitting upgrading of petitions to the H-1B carve-out. And I'm pretty certain that will be available, but not absolutely certain. And again, this is something that I'll actually probably be working on with my committee, convincing the USCIS that they should permit master's degree cases to be converted upwards. Yes?
So what's the difference between upgrading and just sending another application?
Well, first there would be savings in time and money. An H-1B petition... No, but let me just mention that an H-1B petition is pretty expensive for your employer, and if you're paying legal fees and filing fees, et cetera, it can be pretty expensive on the beneficiary, the foreign worker, as well.
Do you lose your line in the queue?
Well, and that would be one of the risks as to whether or not you would lose your place in the H-1B bachelor's degree lottery. Probably the government is not set up to track whether or not a single employer is filing a petition. And factually, I know they're not set up to check whether or not a single employer is filing more than one petition for the same person, because, in fact, there are rumors that many employers did just that to increase their employees' chances of being selected. It's not fair and it's not right that employers did that, but there are employers who file multiple petitions for the same worker in an effort to increase their workers' chances. And so I don't recommend that, but I think if your employer is filing another petition for the same worker in an effort to convert upwards, that would not be an unethical or possibly an illegal action to take. Yes, I didn't answer your question.
No, it's all right. So if you held H-1B status in the past and have not used your 6 years, are you still counted against the cap?
No, and that's a great question. If you've been in H-1B status already, you've already grabbed one of those numbers. And if it's not been more than 6 years, you've got it. And we filed several like that too. We actually filed them on April 2nd because they were just kind of caught up in our wave of H-1B filings. So let's say, let me just say this one thing. Let's say that you are, you're not selected and you don't already have an H-1B number and you can't convert upwards to a master's degree. What are your options? Is all lost, or do you have to go to your home country at the end of your 60-day grace period after your OPT expires? And I'm going to talk to you now about other visa options, and I think this is really important for you to know that there are some other options. It takes very good lawyering. I think that there are some lawyers out there that don't understand a lot of these intricacies. You need a good lawyer on top of this to try to get you into one of the other visa categories. But before I go into those options, let me just answer this. Okay. All right. I mean, what I have to say is more important than what you have to ask? Okay. Makes me nervous. Okay. Are there any, let's get right down to business, are there any people from Mexico or Canada in the room? Yes, because you qualify for TN status. Even if you, this happens to be the fellow that already has an H-1B number, by the way, but if you don't have an H-1B number and you are from Mexico or Canada, you qualify for a visa category called TN. We think that means trade NAFTA. It smells and looks like the H-1B. It's a temporary non-immigrant visa category for professionals, and business administration is on there. There are several other categories related to business under which you might also qualify. It's a pretty streamlined process. There are no numerical limitations. There are no prevailing wage requirements. Do you all know what I mean by that? The H-1B requires that your employer pay you the prevailing wage for the occupation. And this often is a problem for employers because the government's prevailing wage survey is not really reflective of the labor market in many instances. But the employer still has to pay the prevailing wage, and there are a lot of like analytical legal procedures that we go through to figure out what is the correct prevailing wage. The employer also has to file paperwork with the Department of Labor, make certain types of attestations, post the wage at the work site. This is all on the H-1B. They are subject to penalties. They're subject to debarment from the H-1B program. If they violate any of the rules, they have to keep certain types of paperwork. If your employer filed an H-1B for you, you should know that your employer values who you are, because the H-1B is not an easy filing for an employer. But a TN is, because a TN doesn't require any of those headaches that I just spoke about. A TN is a visa category that can actually be applied, in the case of Canadians, can be applied for at the border. In the case of Mexicans, is applied for directly at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico. It's even possible to change status to TN, to switch you over from F1 to TN without you ever having to leave the country. No numerical limitation. The drawback, it's only good for 1 year at a time. The other drawback is that it doesn't allow immigrant intent. Immigrant intent is your intent to become permanent. And this is a legal concept that if your lawyer hasn't already explained this to you, you might want to make an appointment with one of our lawyers just to understand what immigrant intent is about. But briefly, it's the intent to become permanent. In some visa categories, such as the F1, which many of you might have, or J1, doesn't allow you to have immigrant intent and renew your status at the same time. So the TN doesn't allow immigrant intent, but again, that's a mental state of mind and it's a legal term. But it is a great option if you are Mexican or Canadian.
Yeah. So in that case, if you want to get a green card, you have to get an H-1B.
It's better to get an H-1B. However, there are some. It is a timing process, and it's also a mental intent. And again, those are legal issues that, you know, if you come to my office, we'll explain to you and we'll work with you on it.
That's the same thing as the Singapore H-1B.
I don't think that's true on the Singaporean and Chileans, because they're H's, so they can have, not positive, so I'm not going to comment on that. But, okay. Anyone here from down under? Australia?
No.
Oh, now that's too bad, because there are E3s for Australians. Do you have any cousins who are Australian? All right. Okay. Now I want to tell you a little bit about some of the other visa categories. It might be far and few between people who would qualify for these. But if I don't cover them with you, you're not going to know about them. The first one is if you are from a country that has a bilateral treaty with the United States, you might qualify for E1 or E2, or to work with a company that qualifies for E1 or E2. This is called the Treaty Trader and Treaty Investor Visa. Let's just say Mercedes-Benz has a plant down in Alabama. Mercedes-Benz is a German company. Anybody here from Germany?
No.
All right, well, let's see. UK?
No.
Italy?
No.
All right, well, actually...
Mostly Asia, China, Taiwan,
Japan?
India,
yes. Okay. Nissan has plants all over the United States, and Nissan has made a substantial investment in its U.S. operations. Nissan could hire you on any Nissan company, any subsidiary of a Nissan company, could hire you on an E2 visa to fill a managerial, executive, or specialized knowledge position, which probably would be any position that one of you would hold in a company coming from Vanderbilt. That would be a very, very good option And I have actually done several E2s for Japanese clients. The E2s, when I first started practicing immigration law some 20 years ago, there were about 15 E2 countries. Now there are probably almost 100 E2 countries. So it covers a lot of countries. It might be your own. So that would be a very good option worth looking into as to whether or not you qualify for an E2 visa. L1 is a relative of the E2. Let's say that you worked in a company abroad prior to coming to the U.S., and that company has a subsidiary in the United States. The company in the United States could hire you on an L1 visa because you have worked for the related company abroad for at least 1 year out of the past 3. And again, you would qualify for what's called a managerial, executive, or specialized knowledge position. So that's a very real option for some of you. Any of this hitting home for any people? Not yet? Okay. I think you'd be surprised, though, if you start delving into these matters a little more closely. You might find that you might qualify. You may be able, if you're from a country that has an E-treaty with the United States, that's your best bet as to where to start looking for jobs. How can you find out the listing of E-2 countries? Probably if you just go on Google and put E-2 countries, it'll come right up. Or Department of State E-2 countries. If not, contact my office and I'll email a list over to you. Okay. There's another visa category called the O-1. This is for workers of extraordinary ability. You don't think you're extraordinary? You might be. The U.S. government defines extraordinary a little differently than the way you and I might talk about it. And a good immigration lawyer can look at your case and tell you whether or not we can qualify you under the government's terms for extraordinary ability. This is for people who are very good at what they do, who do have some accomplishments in their record. So I'll say this, if you got your bachelor's degree and came straight on to Owens and got your master's degree and you don't have very much work experience and you don't have much experience out in the field, you might be a nice person, but you're probably not extraordinary. But if you've had work experience before you came here, if you've done research, if you've got some publications, if you have done accomplished things professionally before you came to Owens, then you might very well qualify for the O-1 Extraordinary Ability Visa. My office has done a lot of these in the field of business. For example, it would be a case of someone who, what I like to call a turnaround man or a turnaround woman, a person who goes into a company, looks at a large manufacturing company that's starting to go under, and is able to turn that company around by changing the production standards, by looking at personnel, by hiring an industrial engineer to change the layout and turn that company around to profitability. People who have accomplished those types of things, increased employment, increased production, may very well qualify for the O-1 Extraordinary Ability. It allows immigrant intent. It comes in the initial 3-year increment. It's renewable perpetually. Keep getting it in 1-year increments after that. Oh, and I forgot to mention about the E-1 and the E-2. People call that the next best thing to the green card because that visa category is issued in 5-year increments and it's renewable perpetually as long as the company continues. And we do a lot of those, for example, for Japanese businessmen. But anyway, the O-1 also is renewable perpetually. So you might qualify for an O-1. Don't discount yourself. Yes?
What's the success ratio on your extraordinary ability positions?
My success ratio?
What were the markets?
Well, my success ratio is 99.9%. We're not going to do a case if we don't think that it's a really good case. And my office likes to take on the challenging cases, because if it's just a matter of doing cookie cutter cases, it's not fun anymore. We like to take on challenging cases that force us to push this, to push the envelope, to look at a case and really try to work with someone to get them to fit within the category. But I'm not going to do your case if I don't think it's a good case. I don't want to ruin my statistics. So the O1 works. There's an insignificant numerical limitation on O1, so it's not used up every year. And I can just say that my office has done many O1s, including in the business field. We've done a lot on Vanderbilt for the medical center. You look at the people who are doing medical, biomedical research at Vanderbilt University. A lot of those people are in O1s. I do a lot of these in the music industry. You'd be amazed at how many of America's top country music stars are from foreign countries. So the O1, and that's something that I definitely want you to think about. The very fact that you have been that you are graduating from Vanderbilt University with an MBA already suggests that you might be in the category of extraordinary ability. Okay, now here's where we start getting real creative. But we can go to, and I have done this with many clients who are in the H-1B crisis. And this would be to fit someone into a training visa rather than a working visa. And we actually, it takes a little bit of strategizing, but we've actually used this as a stopgap measure when we've had the H-1B crisis. The H-3 and the J-1 are both visas for trainees. It means that you need to work with a company that is willing to put you in a, quote, training position for which you will then eventually go back to your home country or leave the United States to use the training gained in the U.S. somewhere else. Abroad. And it makes sense if you go to work for an international company, let's say, that has operations in Venezuela, we'll just use that as an example, and that company wants to train you in their highly sophisticated quality control systems. And you would be in this training visa for 1 year, and then the plan is that they would then leave upon completion of your training to go to the foreign country and work there, or go back to your home country and find a job. And the idea is that this training gives you a competitive edge that other people in your home country won't have. The company has to have a training plan. Now, sometimes my law firm will assist the company to develop a training plan. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes they already have one in place. Once you enter the training program, if things change, and let's say an H-1B suddenly becomes available, there is no prohibition against switching over to an H-1B at that point. So it is an option that can sometimes, we wouldn't want to, and I want to make this very clear, would not assist an employer to fabricate a training program. But when indeed there is a bona fide training program available and options available for you in your home country, we can put a training program forward. If plans change after that, so be it. There's nothing improper about that.
Does this only go like manufacturing companies, or does it also include something like a hedge fund that invests in your country?
I didn't hear the last part of your question. I said
something like an investment firm, or a
it could, yes, sure.
Does it have like per se any plants or something of that sort, but invest in the stock market?
I think so. The thought could be that they're training you to then go back to your home country, where maybe perhaps you're going to start your own business, start counseling there, and working with this investment company that they want to have a They want to have a branch office in your home country? Very much so. And there was a question over here.
Just wanted to, must it be your home country? Could it be like pushing you to another country, some other place?
Yes, on the H3, yes. The J1, I just have to warn you that there is a requirement for a J1 often that the person must return to their home country for 2 years before they can have an H1B or an L1 or permanent residence. And that is something before you go into it, before you do switch to a J1, make certain that your lawyer, if it's not my firm, whoever the lawyer is, make sure that they have researched whether or not you're subject to what's called the 2-year home residency requirement on a J1. That is something that is generally required for a J1 visa holder. Even if you have J1 for one day and then switch over or decide to leave, you'd then be subject to that 2-year home residency requirement. And it's a home residency, not some other residency. There are pluses and minuses to the J1 versus the H3. They're both very similar in terms of providing a training option. But each has, as I said, pluses and minuses. And by the way, the 2-year home residency requirement can be waived, but not necessarily. Praise the Lord. Anybody here a religious worker? Okay. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. This is actually not the PowerPoint that I wanted, but it's got most of what I had in there. So, I'm just letting you know that there is a visa category for religious workers. Let's just say, you know, you got your master's degree from Owens, but there just are no visa categories available for you to work in the field of business, but you're also closely affiliated with a church, and you might be an ordained minister, you might be able to teach Bible classes. There is a non-immigrant visa category for people to work in the religious professions. You have to prove that you have been a member of that denomination for at least 2 years, and you're doing a, quote, religious job, might serve as a stopgap measure for you. How do I go back? Mm-hmm. Very much so. That would be a definite possibility. And my office does a lot of religious visas. We actually do all of these visas, so, but my partner, Cheryl Williams, who is a graduate of Vanderbilt, does most of the religious worker visas in the office. Okay, if worse comes to worse, and you're left without a job, without a visa category, but you want to stay in the United States to see if the laws are going to change, or if something else might become available, or if you can interview for a job now for another time, B1, B2 visa classification. This is a for business or pleasure. It is hands down a non-working visa. You can't work on this, but it can at least give you a chance to a little more time to go around and interview with prospective employers, find out what options might be available for you. You might even find an employer who's willing to sponsor you for permanent residence. And I'm going to talk about that right now. This is does not allow immigrant intent, and again, is a non-working visa category. But it's something that we have used for people who are in the H-1B cap crisis. Oh, and I forgot to mention one other thing about that L-1 visa, the international transfer. Let's just say you don't have that experience working for an international company abroad, but you have found a company here in the United States that wants to hire you. They can't do that right now because there's no visa category available for you. What if you went back home and worked for one of their companies abroad for 1 year? then you would qualify to be transferred back to the United States on an L-1 visa. In fact, you would even qualify for permanent residence. If you went abroad, worked for the international company abroad for 1 year, and then they transfer you back to the United States. So that's another little piece of information to keep in your back pocket.
What if you just go to the other country, the other location for the gap, and while you're waiting for your H-1B to come in? I mean, can you go work in the international location and while you're waiting for the H-1B to come in effect in October? Would that be an option?
Yes, there's not a requirement that you remain in the United States to await your H-1B.
Can you remain in the U.S. during that gap if you're not working?
If you don't have status, no. And the Immigration Service has even recently, the very first year, I'll tell you a little history, the very first year that we hit the H-1B cap gap early, the Immigration Service issued a policy that allowed students who were in that gap to remain in the United States legally for that 3 or 4 months and then change status to H-1B starting on October 1st. But they've not done that since, and consistently every year they have declined to issue a regulation granting students that special status. And they've already said this year that they do not intend to issue any type of new policy. So
when the OPT ends in June, and we're waiting for the H-1B to go in effect in October, they have to leave the country?
Yes, unless they can switch over to another visa category that would allow them to stay.
Like a B-1?
Possibly a B-1.
Well, no, but they could at least stay in the U.S.
But the B-1, the problem with that is that the B-1 doesn't allow you to stay in the United States if you're intending to work.
Okay.
And so it's a paradox. And sometimes that will be successful and other times not. Yes, I'll answer questions, but if I do that, I'm not going to hit some of the things that I want to tell you. But do you want to...
The one part about permanent residency that may be relevant to you, because I know for most of you, you want to know about H-1B. That's your immediate concern. I understand that. There's one issue that has come up with the permanent residency that Linda wanted to touch on, and that is starting your process for your permanent residency at the same time of petitioning for your H-1B. Should you do that? What does that mean in the long run? So if you want to just touch on that part of the permanent residency issue, I think that's what's relevant to them. Because I think when you're in process with permanent residency, you have certain privileges, rights, or what have you. Okay? So that could be another strategy.
All right. Let's say you want permanent residence. And permanent residence is what people typically call the green card. Has anyone ever seen one? You know that it's not green. Right? It was pink a few years ago and now it's white. But it was actually green, almost the color of your t-shirt, in the 1950s. And it was it was just a little piece of cardboard, and that's how it got the name the green card. But it's actually now a pretty high-tech document that is difficult to reproduce. But people still call it the green card. That's permanent residence. The words immigrant visa, permanent residence, green card, alien registration card, those all mean the same thing. There are three ways to get permanent residence in the United States. Get them through special laws, through employment, and through family. Anybody here, a mother, father, sister, brother, or spouse who's a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident? Well, you might qualify for permanent residence through a family relationship. What is your relative?
My sister.
Forget it. That's a really bad one. That's the least advantageous. Actually, your sister could petition for you. to become a permanent resident, you'd be put on a wait list for 15 years. With no rights during those 15 years. So, all right, you're in the pool with the rest of us here. Labor certification is the most typical way that people like you get permanent residence. It's where an employer sponsors you for permanent residence. They have to prove to the government that there are no qualified Americans available to for the position. Now, there are different visa categories, and they're called, the three most important are called EB1, 2, and 3. That's employment-based visas, 1, employment-based visas, 2, and employment-based visas, 3. Good news for most of you here. You have master's degrees, you are in the employment-based category 2, if your job requires a master's degree. So if you go to an employer and they sponsor you for permanent residence by doing this process called labor certification, you will, and the job requires a master's degree, you will be in the EB2 category. Why is that important? Because just like the H-1B has numerical limitations, the visa categories have numerical limitations, and the visa categories are ridiculously backed up. A position that only requires a bachelor's degree has like a 5 or 6 year wait right now, and depending on some of the countries, Philippines and India, Mexico, the wait can be even longer. If you're in the EB2 category, master's degrees, for most countries, there's no wait. The only countries where there's a wait is China and India. Most of you here right now. Is it most of you here?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So then we still have a problem. I got a question up here.
Sometimes job description says MBA preferred. Would this be anything different than required?
Well, actually, there's been a little bit of a hot debate about that, but the Department of Labor has generally taken the position that preferred means required. Okay. Well, if you're not from China or India, then you know you're in good shape. You can have your employer do it. If you're from China or India, you still should file get a labor certification on file if your employer is interested in you, because more likely than not, Congress is going to allocate more visa numbers with the immigration bill that will eventually get passed. Yes. Go ahead. I got something else I need to say though.
Previous topic. If I get married with a permanent resident, okay. How long does it take for me to get my permanent residence or whatever I get? And am I able to work during that time?
No, you're not. No, it gives you no status whatsoever. You're on the wait list for 5 to 8 years. But we could look at whether or not your spouse is eligible to become a citizen.
And once he
becomes a citizen, automatic permanent residence for spouses of U.S. citizens.
Right.
Okay.
He's a citizen, right?
He'll be by that time, but not yet. But
and if they delay on his naturalization application, come and see me so we can sue the government, because that's the only way to get it done when that happens. I am a lawyer, you know, so that's what we do. So there's another reason why you would want an employer once you get on H-1B. There's another reason why you would want an employer to file a labor certification for you. Because I've told you that I haven't said this, but I think you all know that H-1Bs are limited to 6 years. But if there's a labor certification case that's been filed for you, even if you run out of the 6 years and your visa category still isn't current, you can keep getting H-1B extensions. So there's another distinct advantage to having a labor certification on file. Did everyone understand that? Okay, great. There are ways to get permanent residence through employment, even if you're not getting a labor certification. And there is that multi-manager executive, that's the corollary to the L-1 visa. outstanding, I'm thinking the ones that you all might qualify under, outstanding researchers and professors. If you go to work in a research company, or you get a job at a prestigious university, and extraordinary ability. If some of you out there already have some experience before you came to Owens, you may qualify as extraordinary ability. I assume none of you are registered nurses or physical therapists? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Linda, can I, because I know this is starting to get into more of...
Do you want me to skip all this?
Yeah, because okay. A couple questions that they have...
Well, could I just ask, does anyone here have $1 million to spare? No, right, because if you had $1 million, you can get your permanent residence also as an entrepreneurial investor. You need a master's degree from Owens to know how to invest that much money, but, okay.
Some of the questions that you had that may relate, someone asked about the L1 visa, Ravish, so I think you got that answer.
Okay.
Can you work for free for the company during that gap? In other
words, great question, and I can't tell you how many people are asking this question right now. And the answer is no, because work is work, whether it's paid or unpaid. And even if it's deemed volunteer, what the government would look at is whether or not the parties, meaning the employer and the employee, are gaining a benefit from the volunteer work. And there clearly would be a benefit to the employer, and for the employee the benefit would be that, you know, you're going to get sponsored for permanent residence, or you're getting experience, or you're going to get an H-1B eventually. So volunteer work doesn't work. Orientation is okay. Attending a seminar or a conference is okay. Going in to do something one time where you're not on schedule, you know, not being on a regular schedule, is that would be considered work. I actually had someone in the religious professions ask me that question because they wanted to bring this pastor into their church and not wait the 6 months that it takes to process a religious petition. And I said, he can come in and do an occasional sermon, but don't put him on the regular schedule, and don't pay him anything, not even tithe offerings. And that might be okay, but anything beyond that would be considered work.
Can you be on a medical leave during the gap?
On an H-1B?
When your OPT is over, when the OPT is done and you're waiting for the H-1B to start during that gap, can you be on a medical leave, say if you're pregnant?
A B-1, possibly, if someone could qualify for a B-1, if you have a serious medical condition. I got to let you know that there are some bills pending before Congress, one of which, the skill bill, would increase H-1Bs to 115,000. This bill has a chance, and that's really your answer. There's also the STRIVE bill, which would do something similar, and there is comprehensive immigration reform pending before Congress. Let me see if there's anything else important to say. Questions and answers. So there are bills pending before Congress. You need to keep an eye on those, and those might be your solutions. If you would like more information, you can set up a consultation to come into my office. Quick questions, easy questions, I could take a few on email, just send them over to me, and I'll try to answer them. If I get bombarded, I can't answer them all. Thanks, everybody. I'm sorry we got cut short.